We've been meeting again today with another of our prospective faculty candidates. He gave a job talk back in September, John Plosky from Yale University. So he's back visiting, trying to convince his fiancée now that she wants to move to Dallas. So if things work out, then we will have a molecular biologist that's interested in the nervous system as one of our faculty, too. He's interested in gene expression and in learning and memory. And if it doesn't work out, then our next candidate on the list is also a molecular biologist interested in gene expression and learning and memory. So one way or another, we will have somebody of that sort joining our faculty. Dr. Robert Reniker is already here on campus, but he's not teaching yet. He won't be teaching until the fall. I'm sorry, until next spring. He's going to teach neurophysiology in the spring. And then Dr. Sven Kroner has already signed on, and he will be teaching cellular neuroscience starting in the fall. Okay, so the neuroscience program is expanding, okay, so take advantage of that fact. There will be more opportunities again in the future for more people working in more labs as well. Yes? Pardon? Dr. Adzori has been teaching neurophys, but Dr. Collar sometimes teaches neurophys too. So Dr. Reniker will join the group of people teaching neurophysiology. He will be teaching it in spring of 2010. Yes, this coming spring. It's hard to believe it's almost 2010 already. Okay. All right, for everyone that can read and for those that can't, this is the schedule up here for the review session. Next Monday, Linda will be holding a review. Since we rushed through the end of sleep last time, I've decided, since this is not a democratic process, that I'm going to push our exam back by one day. Okay, so we will talk more about sleep today and then cover the other two topics for the next exam next week. So there won't be an exam a week from today. It will be a week from Tuesday. Okay. Pardon? So it will be one class meeting later than what the syllabus says. Okay. No, it will be Tuesday the 3rd. No, Tuesday the 10th. Tuesday the 10th. And if there was any markers up here, I would write that. Good. The exam will be Tuesday the 10th. Okay. So mark your calendars appropriately, and if you want to play nasty tricks on somebody that's missed class today, you can tell them we moved it up a day earlier the other way, but that would be a very nasty trick, and I'm not responsible for anything bad that they do to you as in consequence. Now, pass the word, if friends of yours are not here today, that the exam will be on the 10th, okay? All right. So I think we had gotten to about this point when my laptop battery died the other day, talking about developmental regulation of sleep. If we took any dozen of you at random and paid you for a month's vacation and put you in some setting where you had no pressing obligations, you could get up whenever you wanted, you could sleep whenever you wanted, you could eat and drink and do whatever else you wanted throughout the day, and then repeated this experiment multiple times, we would get a graph that looks something like this, a normal distribution of the amount of sleep that the individuals get on average in a night's time. And we'd want to do this for at least a month because there's going to be daily variability even without any conflicting outside influences, like you have to get up at 4 a.m. because you're catching a plane that time, or you know, you can't get to sleep till 3 a.m. because you forgot that you've got a paper due tomorrow, or those sorts of things. Okay? So on average, it looks like typical humans sleep about 7.5 hours a night on average. But if you look, this is a normal distribution. So there are people at the shallow end of this curve that are only sleeping about 4.5 hours a night. And there are people at the top end of this curve that are sleeping 10.5 hours a night. Typically, when you're more than about a standard deviation outside that normal median score, and you tell this to a physician, they start to get worried about you. So if you're sleeping down at this end of the curve, they're starting to wonder if you've got some sort of a sleep disorder. Or if you're sleeping out towards this end of the curve, they start to wonder if you're depressed or you have some physiological problem going on that is pushing you in that direction. Okay, so we'll talk about a few different types of sleep disorders, and there are literally hundreds of different ones that have been clinically described at this point in time. Now, this is the typical sort of distribution for adults. And neurobiologically speaking, you're all adults. But we know that during the lifespan of humans, the amount of sleep that you engage in on a daily basis varies by your age. And in fact, this graph is probably wildly inaccurate. For instance, it's got this part in pink here where humans literally don't exist. Sometime prior to conception, no sleeping's going on. Okay, saying that sleep starts immediately after conception is sort of probably completely wrong, because there isn't even a brain at that point in time. In fact, it's not until several weeks after conception that you begin to form a neurotube. And those of you that have had developmental neuroscience know all about that sort of thing, I'm hoping, by this point in time. Those of you that haven't, we'll be learning a lot more about that in the future. It's really not until about midway through pregnancy, closer to the second trimester, that you really begin to have enough of a nervous system to really begin to talk about sleep. And we know at that point in time that the fetus is sleeping most of the time because the mother has not noticed movement of the fetus up to that point in time. But once the fetus begins to not sleep all the time, then the mother experiences being kicked by the infant during certain periods when it's actually not asleep. It's in the waking state. And in some very rare instances, people have actually monitored cortical activity in fetuses in utero and detected brainwave changes that are somewhat akin to what we see in born individuals, I guess would be the correct terminology in Texas these days. At birth, this point on the graph here, infants are typically sleeping two-thirds of the day or more. And it's not in one solid block of 16 hours, as parents quickly learn. In fact, infants rarely time their sleeping to when it is convenient for their parents. And in fact, typically wait until their parents try to get their few hours of sleep, because they're then somewhere down on this end of the distribution curve. And then the infant wakes up and wants some type of care. But over that first year of life, the percentage of sleeping declines at a fairly gradual rate until this graph begins to become inaccurate. Okay, by about 1 year of age, it says that infants are sleeping about 12 hours a day. Many infants are sleeping somewhere in that range, but tend to be a little bit underneath that value. But where I really have trouble with this graph, which is right from your textbook, is in this range from 1 year of age to 20 years of age. How many of you, when you were 10 years old, were sleeping 12 hours a day? I think in the U.S. at least, that would be an extremely rare phenomenon by age 10. That'd be fourth or fifth graders. And certainly not in middle school are very many people sleeping 10 hours a day. And I don't think very many 20-year-olds are sleeping 8 hours a day these days. How many of y'all got 8 hours of sleep last night? Okay, keep your hands up. How many got seven? Keep your hands up. Don't put them back down. How many got six? See, we still haven't even hit 50%. 6 hours. And I think we could safely say that you're a fairly representative population. Okay, I don't think we have too many aberrant drug problems in the class right now. Not too many examples of various states of brain damage. Okay. Probably most of you have not been shot at recently. Okay. So in terms of major stressors or things of that sort, I think we could say this is a fairly typical population. So I think these graphs tend to be a bit outdated, or at least based on speculative data rather than real data. We do know that the amount of sleep that people get tends to decrease with age. And in fact, from age 20 onward, it continues to decrease. Not only does the total amount of time decrease, but the type of sleep that people obtain varies at different ages. So in young children, they spend an awful lot of time in slow wave sleep, and not as much time in REM sleep as young adults. From about puberty onward, you tend to stabilize in this sort of pattern that we looked at before, where you have several periods of slow wave sleep and then most of the REM sleep occurring later in the night. And the total percentage of REM sleep is actually more than you got in childhood. However, beginning about age 50 or so, you begin to see these sorts of patterns where many people do not get very much slow wave sleep and as a consequence begin to lose the amount of REM sleep that they gain each night as well. And it's a progressive change. So each individual over time begins to lose slow wave and perhaps more seriously lose REM sleep. And REM seems to be particularly important for things like consolidation of memory, and particularly for what we would call the restorative qualities of sleep. It appears that the slow wave, where you're regenerating ATP, is not sufficient for you to feel rested. You also need a significant amount of REM sleep to really feel rested, to really feel alert the next day. It's been well known for a long time that sleep deprivation has consequences. So for instance, down at the bottom of here, we're fairly familiar with short-term consequences. I think this is a picture from over in a computer science class. This is maybe in a psychology class here. I'm sure you've all seen examples of this. If you walk up and down the hallways around here, people sleeping on pretty minimal comfort furniture, sleeping on the floor. And this is clear signs of an individual that was so sleep deprived, really doesn't matter to them where they can lay down for a few minutes or more than a few minutes, whether that's intended or not, and get some sleep back. Okay. I've never experienced this in the classroom yet, thankfully. So we know that REM rebound is a very common phenomenon. It can cause issues like car accidents, cognitive deficits, a number of other sorts of things. Again, I reminded you that before your next exam, whether it's in this class or another one, you'll be much better off spending your last 8 hours sleeping than studying if you want to do well. But in fact, long-term consequences of sleep deprivation are often fatal. If you deprive an individual of sleep for a month or more, they will often die. And this has been done literally thousands of times at experimental settings, but there is a human literature on this too. It's not the sort of thing that anyone can do these days experimentally, but it has been done as forms of torture in the past, or under extreme conditions where someone literally could not sleep or they would drown or something of that sort. A very common way to do sleep deprivation in the laboratory requires very little expenditure as opposed to the mechanism that's shown in your textbook. The very common method that's used in laboratories is you go out and buy some very cheap flower pots. And flower pots, if you've ever looked at them, come in a whole variety of different diameters. And you take a flower pot and turn it upside down and set it in a large pool of water. And then you can put an animal on that and use it to deprive it of sleep. You can completely deprive an animal of sleep if you pick a small enough flower pot. So if the animal even begins to nod off, it falls off the flower pot. So for instance, if you had a 1-inch diameter flower pot, the animal's going to have to spend all its time trying to stay on top. And every time it starts to nod off, boosh, out into the water. That fairly effectively wakes the animal up. If you make the water deep enough, they don't wake up, they die. That's not how they got these curves, though. But falling into water, even for you, would wake you up. Okay? So you could do complete sleep deprivation. And over time, take them out, allow them, you know, time to eat, put them back on the flower pot. Over time, they begin to lose weight. Even though at the same time, they're actually increasing their food intake. Eventually, it's taking so much energy to stay awake constantly that they can't take in enough, and they die. You can do a slightly less cruel version of this by a slightly larger diameter flower pot. Now the animal can sleep, as long as it's only slow wave sleep. Which of the two types of sleep, REM or slow wave, did you lose muscle tone? REM sleep. Okay, the characteristic of a REM sleep is skeletal muscle atonia, lack of muscle tone. So when they go into slow wave sleep, they can curl up enough on this slightly larger flower pot that they can get slow wave sleep. Until they lose muscle tone, now they roll off the flower pot. Into the water, wake up. And if you're monitoring their EEG activity, which is a little more trouble to do, you can show that they'll typically get less than 0.5% of REM in any given day's period. As soon as they go into REM, into the water. They're getting plenty of slow wave sleep. In fact, most of them will increase the amount of slow wave sleep they're getting. What happens to these curves? They get pushed out just a little bit by about 2 days. Not getting REM sleep is almost as bad as not getting any sleep at all. And in fact, if you look at their cognitive ability, it declines more rapidly, selectively depriving them of REM than depriving them of all sleep. The brain seems to like these sorts of patterns on a circadian basis, a daily basis. Most of you have probably experienced being up without sleeping for one night. You think you were functioning optimally the next day? How many of you have ever gone without sleep for 2 nights? Okay, how many of you for a week? Anybody? None of you have ever been in the military then, huh?
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It's hard to remember.
It's hard to remember if it was a week or not. That's one of the signs. Okay? Certain kinds of survival training they'll send you on. You probably won't sleep for a week. No REM sleep?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you have to be standing up at least?
No.
No? Well, that's an improvement then. Your cognitive abilities decline very rapidly with the increasing amount of sleep deprivation. So again, if you want to be doing better at your GPA in college, one easy way to improve it is to get more sleep. Not that you should stop studying to get more sleep, but maybe you should stop carrying out certain other activities that are also cutting into your sleep time. Okay. All right. We've seen repeatedly that the human brain does not appear to be the optimal design for a nervous system. Well, this is an example where we do not have the best design for sleeping. When we go to sleep, our entire brain goes to sleep. Certain portions of it are synchronously active in slow wave sleep. Certain portions are very active during REM sleep, while other portions are inhibited. But there are some species that have come up with other solutions. So a large group of different species called the cetaceans, this is one example, a dolphin. They are mammals. They live in an aquatic environment. Being mammals, they have to breathe air. They don't have gills. To stay at the surface, which is where air is present, that they can breathe through their lungs, they have to swim. So if they spend a third of the day sleeping, there probably wouldn't be any cetacean species. They'd come up with a better solution. When they rest, one hemisphere of their brain sleeps, and the other is wide awake. And they divide their day up, typically, where about a third of the day, both hemispheres are awake, and the other two-thirds of the day, one hemisphere or the other is awake. And when one is awake, the other is sleeping. As a consequence, 24 hours a day, they are swimming. They spend the majority of the time when both hemispheres are awake in activities that we would call work. Hunting for food. But if they're in the right environment, they don't even have to spend that entire 8 hours working. Most of the time they're engaged in play activity or sex. The other two-thirds of the time, they're swimming along with their school of other dolphins or whales, or have gotten themselves into a situation where less than 100% brain capacity is all that's needed. It's often been theorized that humans don't use their full capacity most of the time anyway. So we perhaps could get by with 50% as well. It's hard to do that test on us without anesthetizing one side, which is not the same thing as putting it to sleep. But these species have been around a long time, very successfully. Okay, you think about most humans, they spend at least 8 hours a day working. And they only get to go to the beach like these creatures maybe once a year. So maybe this is a better solution over the long term. Yes?
Does this pertain to aquatic mammals, or is this true of all aquatic animals, like fishes as well?
Fish don't have the same sleeping patterns. No, it varies a lot across different orders of animals. But the aquatic mammals show this pattern. Okay. Fish just, depending on the species, have to keep moving. Keep things flowing through their gills. Some of them appear not to sleep at all. So sleep particularly seems to be a need that mammals have, the particular types of sleep that we have. Some of the lower organisms do exhibit things that look somewhat like sleep, though, but different in many different ways. But even if you look at worms or much lower organisms, they still have quiescent periods, but they come up with lots of different solutions depending on what their environmental needs are as well. But for the aquatic mammals, this is a hallmark. So no matter what time of day it is, part of their brain is always aware and always ready to respond to the outside environment. And in fact, if circumstances arise, they wake up very quickly. Their entire brain. Yes?
Do they
Do they have REM sleep and non-REM sleep? Yes. They have sleep stages, in fact, very similar to humans. Not only that, but they have a larger brain than we do, and larger in proportion to their body mass. They, in fact, appear to have a much more complex language than we do, in terms of the number of different vocalizations that they emit and the way they respond to those vocalizations. They also emit little things that humans have, like warfare. But then again, humans don't beach themselves either. Okay? We just commit suicide instead. So you come up with your own conclusions whether this is a better brain than ours. Okay. The last set of things I wanted to talk about sleep, and hopefully most of the things I'll talk about don't apply to the majority of the people in the class, but some of them undoubtedly will generate personal interest, is different types of sleep disorders. Okay, so these are among the most common types of sleep disorders, but it's certainly not an all-inclusive list. Insomnia is one that is very common. Trouble going to sleep or staying asleep. And they're not necessarily the same thing. Someone that lays down in a dark, quiet environment. In fact, it could be an environment where everyone else in that environment is asleep, and hours later they're still not asleep, would be characterized as having insomnia. As opposed to someone that sleeps for a few hours and then wakes up. That's typically characterized as a different type of sleep disorder. And there's a number of different causes that could be related to that. But insomnia is a very common type of problem. Most people, in fact, experience it at least once in their life. Some experience it on a daily basis. It's when it's occurring on a regular basis that it then becomes clinically relevant. Another very common sleep disorder, one related often to snoring, we'll look at this in a little more detail in a moment, is what's called sleep apnea, or problems with breathing. Particularly obstructive sleep apnea, where the airway literally closes off, usually because of soft tissue in the palate or in the throat. And the individual actually becomes anoxic for a period of time. Their blood oxygen levels actually fall below optimal levels. And as a consequence, levels of pH build up. Levels of CO2 build up in the blood gases, and the pH of the blood changes, and that's usually what then triggers the onset of breathing again, usually with a loud sound accompanying it. Okay. Another one that gets advertised a lot, because there's lots of pharmaceutical companies trying to market products for it, is a phenomenon called restless leg syndrome. It's unclear to me whether the incidence is really as high as this chart shows. Drug companies would like to pretend it's twice as high as this. Obviously, if you've got a drug, you need to be able to market it to someone. And this would be a syndrome where, especially during REM sleep, you don't have paralysis of the muscles, particularly in the legs, but it actually shows up in the arms as well. So you get a lot of movement during REM sleep. Then there are a number of other disorders. REM behavioral disorder. Not only do you have increased muscle activity, but often organized sorts of behaviors. It can take the form of things like sleepwalking, but any number of other forms as well. And then finally, much rarer is narcolepsy, an inability to stay awake. REM rebound in its extreme form, or at least an instantaneous change from a waking state into something resembling REM sleep. Okay. As I said, this is not an all-inclusive list, and I'll go over some of these in a little more detail. Here's an example most people have probably experienced that is technically a sleep disorder, jet lag. Okay? When you've been acclimated to a particular time zone, now you get on an aircraft and very rapidly, within a few hours' time, are one or more time zones different. Now what happens to your sleep afterwards? Usually the first day, your body has been set to a particular time zone and it tries to stay on that time zone, even though the environment you're now in is not attuned to that time zone. So for instance, if you had been in Europe and now come to Texas, suddenly, when it's morning in Texas, it's late in the day in Europe. So you're likely the first night you're back, depending on when you came in, waking up very early and being tired very early in the day. If you came from the West Coast to Texas, everybody else is tired and going to bed, and it seems pretty early to you. Takes a while for your circadian clock to adjust. And in fact, if you monitor the suprachiasmatic nucleus, you will see that it has to go through a phase shift of its activity to get you back in sync with the place that you're located presently. But for a while, you're out of sync with your external environment. Even though all the cues are there, you've got an alarm clock in different places. The sun is coming up, you know, at dawn and going down at sunset, but you're responding to the prior conditions that the suprachiasmatic nucleus had put itself into tune with. And it can take anywhere from a day to multiple days to get back in phase. They can vary by individual as well. Okay. Sleepwalking is a not uncommon problem, also called somnambulism. Nambulism meaning walking around, som from the root word for sleep. And unlike typical sleepers, where during REM sleep, which nucleus was it in the brainstem between the peduncles? Anybody remember? The pedunculopontine nucleus that typically is inhibiting movement by stimulating Renshaw cells during REM sleep. That appears to not be functioning properly in individuals with sleepwalking problems. And so they are active during REM sleep periods. Some people just move around a lot, but some literally get up and act out whatever they're dreaming about. How many of you, every time you dream, your dream makes total logical sense? Probably not very many of you. So some dreams, maybe you'd be willing to act them out, but some of them, you probably better not. There have been court cases that have used somnambulism as a defense. So far, legally, most courts don't accept that. But there are clearly good examples of people that drive cars. In fact, some prescription drugs I'll point to in a moment caution you against continuing to take them if you notice you're driving your car while you're asleep. People that gain a tremendous amount of weight because they get up and go to the refrigerator and binge eat while they're asleep. Been a number of court cases of people engaging in sexual activity while they were asleep. Everything from rape cases to consensual acts. And then, of course, restless leg syndrome seems to be tied into that as well. This is not an uncommon, it's not extremely common, but not an uncommon disorder. That varies. And there are different types that are identified by whether their eyes are open or not. It's not clear just because their eyes are open, though, that they're actually processing visual information normally. And in fact, if you wake someone up from a sleepwalking episode, their report of what is going on does not make it seem like they were awake, you know, just a little bit different from normal. No, REM sleep is quite different from the waking state. Yes. Well, the common belief is that most people outgrow sleepwalking. There's not really good long-term studies of that, though, to show that that's entirely true. The incidence seems to fall off after adolescence. But it's not clear that that means that they've just stopped or the disorder is gone, or maybe it's being converted to another form. Now you don't? Or at least not that you know of now. And that's not happening anymore. Well, that's good. I hope it stays that way. Okay. Do you thrash your covers off or anything like that? No? So, I mean, anecdotally, that's what's reported, is that most people outgrow it. But no, I don't know that there's been a good clinical follow-up to see if that's universally true, or if that's a certain percentage, or if some actually convert to other forms, like RLS or something else. Okay.
Can this occur?
It's a good question, though.
Can this occur because of an emotional onset?
Well, it can. In fact, some people can sleepwalk once, and that's the only event in their entire life.
So it can be emotional disturbance that may...
Well, it's hard to say, particularly if it only happens once, because there's probably been other emotional events, and they didn't do it. So it's often hard sometimes to pin down the cause of some of these disorders. Okay. Obstructive sleep apnea. Poor old grandpa on the Simpsons was a particularly bad example. But most individuals snore to some degree at some time. Many do not do it all the time. But you put a person in the wrong position, particularly if you look at some of the people that are sleeping on some of the things out in the hallways around here, you may notice an increased amount of snoring activity. Snoring is typically a very brief form of obstruction of the airway, but when it becomes more severe, you can actually see that blood oxygen levels fall very precipitously. They don't have pH on this particular graph, but pH is going up at the same time oxygen is going down because of the increased CO2 levels. Respirations actually have stopped during that apneic event. And then when the pH gets high enough, suddenly reflex activity kicks in. There's a small group of neurons in the brainstem. When pH gets high enough, forces movement of the diaphragm and causes at least a momentary burst of breaths. But then this can often repeat hundreds of times within an hour in people with very severe sleep apnea. There are various surgical treatments people have tried, most of them not very successful. To remove enough tissue to actually guarantee that you couldn't occlude the airway, then you end up with not a very functional trachea afterwards. The most common type of treatment is use of what is called a CPAP device, continuous positive airway pressure. So a person has to actually fit it over their mouth and or nose. If it's over just the nose, then their mouth has to be closed in some manner. And it increases the pressure within the airway so that now the soft tissue acting against that pressure can't completely close it down. And that's actually a very effective treatment for sleep apnea. It's one that insurance companies will even pay for. So any number of different mouth devices and stuff that are sold, marketed late at night on television, I guess for people that have woken up because they have sleep apnea. Most of those are highly ineffective and not medically approved. And insurance companies won't pay for those. It's not always a sign that if an insurance company pays for something, it's effective, but they tend to not pay for things that they're going to get sued for. And if someone has one of those mouth devices and asphyxiates, they could be liable for paying a death settlement. Okay. We talked about insomnia, especially the one where you have difficulty going to sleep. Hours and hours and hours of attempts to go to sleep, and the person is still wide awake. That's often credited to emotional activity, circumstances in life. But then again, it tends to induce stress in people when they can't sleep. Typical individuals, most of them, it only takes a few minutes to half an hour to go to sleep. Insomniacs, it takes a long time to go to sleep. So if you have two populations and compare them, it's easy to tell which is the insomniac population. Okay. As a consequence, unless they've got all of the next 24 hours to sleep, when they do eventually get to sleep, if they get to sleep, they tend to end up being sleep deprived. And many people that study sleep think that there's a flip side to that, which we would call hypersomnia, sleeping too much. Perhaps similar mechanisms involved. In one case, whatever allows you to go to sleep being either actively inhibited or not activated strongly enough, and in the other case, perhaps not being inhibited enough or being overactivated. It's not yet clear what the specific mechanisms are. For instance, insomniacs don't have lower levels of adenosine receptors. So it's not that they're not tired. If you ask a typical insomniac, they'll tell you they're tired all the time. So the mechanism is not yet clear. There's a lot more we need to know about sleep. Try to figure out why someone is sleeping too much. Typical first question that people ask is, are you depressed? And if they say no, then you probe to see if they're denying that they're depressed. Because about 80% of the time, depression seems to be one of the comorbidity factors in excess levels of sleep. Could just be that the person has been very active and has been up for several days doing lots of things, and now they're catching up on their sleep. But it could be indicative of other problems. Okay. Pharmaceutical companies again. Very, very commonly used compounds, sleeping pills. And there are a huge number of different varieties of compounds that people use if they claim that they are insomniac or having problems sleeping. Everything from over-the-counter antihistamines, which are actually very effective at putting you to sleep, and have, in some cases, fewer side effects than the ones that are marketed as specifically sleeping pills. These are some of the newer ones that are on the market, Ambien and Lunesta. They act by agonizing certain sites associated with benzodiazepine sites on GABA-A receptors. So they enhance inhibition in the central nervous system. They induce a state similar to a coma. They're dose-dependent and time-dependent. So if you take the appropriate dose, you will be unconscious for a period of about 6 to 8 hours. And they calculate out a typical adult body dose in a couple of tablets, so most people will sleep about 8 hours. I say sleep, but really they're more like they're comatose. Look at a typical sleep pattern. Lots of slow wave sleep and then gradually more REM sleep. People that have had sleep problems and they take sleeping tablets like these for short term, for a few days, don't get very much slow wave sleep. They actually spend time more in the intermediate stages, stage two particularly. Not as much REM sleep as they would have typically had, but the first few days they may still be getting REM sleep. But look what happens after they've been taking them chronically for a week or more. Now essentially no slow wave sleep, only stage two as the deepest sleep that they're getting, and very little REM sleep. So even though these are FDA approved, if you just listen to the side effects that are listed as common events, besides the things like sleep driving and things of that sort, you might question whether these are actually beneficial compounds. There have been a number of studies showing severe cognitive deficits in people taking these for long term, besides the fact that you can overdose on them readily. If you're still feeling tired, so you decide, well, I just must not have taken enough, so instead of taking two, I'll take eight for the next week. Because they are increasing inhibition in your nervous system. Same overdose potential as anything else that acts as a downer in the nervous system. So probably should not be FDA approved drugs. But there's a huge demand for drugs like these. And in the U.S., demand tends to drive things rather than the reality of what these compounds are doing. After people discontinue taking these drugs, they exhibit REM rebound, whether you took it for one night or for long term. They also go through slow wave rebound, but particularly significant is the amount of REM rebound that occurs, because they were sleep deprived by the drugs. They were laying quiet for 8 hours. So if it's a social issue, well, then they're sleeping. But it's really not restful, normal sleep. Fortunately, very uncommon problem, although a great humor to cartoonists. Narcolepsy, suddenly shifting from being awake into REM sleep. Consequent loss of muscle tone. It's probably not very restful to have your face suddenly inserted into your dinner. May or may not wake up the individual, though. And so it could be very hazardous to your health in various ways as well. Plus, socially, it could be a problem. You never knew when you were going to suddenly slump over asleep. Might limit your career choices. Hopefully you wouldn't decide to become an airline pilot, long-haul truck driver, not even a taxi driver, hopefully. Might make it even difficult to be a student. You could never predict when you're going to go to sleep. Probably have bad consequences if it happened at the start of an exam, for instance. Maybe not in this class. I might actually believe you if you said, well, I didn't finish the final because I fell asleep. But I don't know if you'd be able to use that excuse in very many classes. Okay. So there are literally dozens and dozens of different sleep disorders. take-home message is we don't know enough about how and why the brain sleeps to really begin to intelligently address them. We need a lot more research into the basic mechanisms of sleep and into the disorders before we actually have good treatments for them. All right? So again, if you came in late, the exam has been pushed back by one class meeting.